I'm going to ask everybody to take their seats so we can get started, so that we can hear from you as well as from us. I'm Sarah Mendelson, Senior Fellow in the Russia and Eurasia Program here at CSIS. Welcome. It's our great pleasure to be hosting this event. Before I introduce Dr. Helga Conrad, I want to thank our partner in this event, the Vital Voices Global Partnership, has been involved, as many of you know, in anti-trafficking work for a decade. And Vital Voices advocates for constructive policy change through public awareness campaigns, NGO capacity building, and the convening of policymakers, NGOs, and law enforcement. And Wenxi Yu Perkins, director of the Anti-Trafficking and Human Rights Program of Vital Voices, works closely with Dr. Conrad's office in the region, and as some of you may know, they together hosted a conference in Cyprus in late June. I want to thank Vital Voices for asking us to co-host this event with Dr. Conrad, and especially the help that Wenxi lent us in pulling this together. I came to know Dr. Conrad through a project that I was running here at CSIS that looked specifically at human trafficking and peacekeeping operations in the Balkans. Part of the goal of that project, in addition to writing Barracks and Brothels, which I just have to advertise, was to bring together a transnational network that would address the demand side of human trafficking and peacekeeping settings. In other words, we were interested in seeing the organizations that mount peacekeeping missions understand and address their own role and that of their personnel in trafficking. Obviously, the majority serve honorably, but a minority have been involved in human trafficking, as many of us in this room have documented. I was greatly helped in pulling this network together when Dr. Conrad invited me to participate in a meeting of her Stability Pact Task Force in June 2003 in Vienna. Several members of that task force, including Dr. Conrad, joined CSIS, the Norwegian and the U.S. mission, in March 2004 at NATO headquarters to discuss for the first time at NATO this issue. That event helped lead to the creation of a policy on trafficking adopted by NATO at the Istanbul Summit in June 2004. We at CSIS hope to continue our work on this over the next few years, bringing us together as well as observing in the field how organizations are implementing their policies. It's worth repeating that we believe there is a role and a need for non-governmental actors and international organizations such as the OSCE to help monitor the implementation of recent policies adopted by NATO, the UN, and the US Department of Defense. A few weeks ago, NATO sources tell me troops from a NATO contingent were detained in a case involving the trafficking of women and girls in Kosovo. Around the same time, as well as earlier this year, UN personnel also in Kosovo were detained also in relation to human trafficking. As many of you know, a few weeks ago, an entire contingent was removed from the UN mission in the Congo for engaging in sexual abuse and exploitation. So this is obviously an ongoing problem. We welcome the policies that have been adopted, but we're going to all be watching to see how they're implemented, how the peacekeeping culture changes over time. To give us a broader perspective, and with a particular focus on Southeastern Europe, to give us the OSCE perspective, and to help amplify the voices of those who are trafficked, and to help us think through some policy solutions, we're lucky to have Helga Conrad with us today. Dr. Helga Conrad was appointed the OSCE Special Representative on Combating Trafficking in Human Beings by the OSCE Chair in office on 10 May 2004. From 2000 to October 2004, she chaired the Stability Pact Task Force on Trafficking in Human Beings for Southeastern Europe, established under the auspices of the OSCE. From 1995 to 1997, Dr. Conrad was the Federal Minister for Women's Issues in the Austrian government and hosted the first EU conference on trafficking in women for the purpose of sexual exploitation in 1996. She was head of the Austrian government delegation to the 4th UN World Conference on Women in Beijing and the World Congress Against Commercial Sexual Exploitation of Children in Stockholm in 1996. Thank you very much. Here is Dr. Helga Conrad.
Thank you. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. It's an honor to be here. And I would like, as you asked me to do, to focus a bit on Southeastern Europe, but of course, the problem of human trafficking is a very it cannot be solved in a certain region. You know, no country alone will be able to address this problem effectively and successfully. So, therefore, what I have to say about Southeastern Europe is also relevant beyond this very region. So over the last years, we all know that trafficking in human beings and the fight against it has been receiving ever more attention, not only in Southeastern Europe, but in all Western Europe and beyond. And you mentioned the OSCE. Let me just say a few words what it is. The OSCE consists of 55 participating states, including all Western European countries reaching out to transatlantic partners such as the US and Canada, includes also the Commonwealth of Independent States, Caucasus, Central Asia, and we cooperate also with our Asian and Mediterranean partners. And you might ask, so what is the basis for our work? So these 55 participating states have committed themselves to rigorously fight human trafficking. So there are already signed commitments there, and we have also developed a comprehensive action plan, OSCE action plan, and it is my task with my team to see how to put, or let's say to be a catalyst in supporting the implementation of these commitments, because to sign something is relatively easy, yeah, but to put it into practice, to implement it, is a more difficult endeavor. So this is the situation on the basis of which we work. I would also address governments and those responsible on the spot. These are governments. International organizations such as ours and others and NGOs have certainly an important role to play, but it's the governments responsible to implement the right measures against human trafficking. So we would work with them and try to generate also the political will to make them to understand. And this will be the issue I would anyway like to focus on, also with the peacekeepers, really, because the main issue certainly is to understand what's going on. Otherwise, all the regulations and what we tell them to do won't be very fruitful. In Southeastern Europe, this fight against human trafficking has always been an integral part of the reform process undertaken in the region, also because human trafficking has brought implications for the stability in the region and beyond. This was quickly understood. It has implications for the further democratization, for the rule of law, and last but not least also, and this is important for the countries in Southeastern Europe, for the integration of the Southeastern European countries into the EU. In Southeastern Europe, some years ago, was a post-war and post-conflict area, and we all know that in such an area the problem of human trafficking is compounded by the instability of civil society, by weak governments, by weak institutions, by weakened rule of law. And in Southeastern Europe, there was an additional fact. This was the moving in of tens of thousands of men in uniform. And this obviously created a market for sexual services. The traffickers took advantage of this fact, and we could see a large increase of trafficking in human beings. And I shall later on come back to the role of the peacekeepers in fighting human trafficking or in contributing to human trafficking. There have been a number of high-profile conferences in recent years. A number of countries have either adopted new anti-trafficking laws or amended their criminal codes in order to provide for the specific crime of human trafficking. We can look with a certain sense of satisfaction at the fact that almost all countries in Southeastern Europe have already ratified the UN Protocol on Trafficking in Persons, and many have also signed the new Council of Europe Convention on Action Against Trafficking in Human Beings. And only recently, if you may know, the EU has started to develop an EU action plan to combat trafficking in human beings. So there will be a conference in Brussels within a few days on the 19th and 20th of October in order to further discuss such an action plan. So many good things have been and continue to be done in the fight, continue to be done to fight this serious crime and human rights violation. Regional and national mechanisms and framework have been put in place. A whole range of efforts have been made, measures and actions taken. While there are signs of progress in the fight against human trafficking, especially when it comes to institutional mechanisms that did not exist several years ago, there is little evidence that we have succeeded in curbing this crime. Consequently, we must reflect on these facts and use them to evaluate our strategies and efforts and improve upon them. And if you allow, I would like to do this a bit, to look at the assumptions and maybe also at new developments. We have a recent report of the regional clearing point in Belgrade. They have done research on assisted and protected victims of trafficking in the region. So these are concrete figures. It's not estimates. Yeah, it's not just what they believe or what it could be, but they asked victims who had accepted assistance and protection. So in recent years, there has seemed to be a decrease in victims identified and assisted in the region. This fact should not be misinterpreted. It is not a sign that human trafficking in general is decreasing, but rather that trafficking has moved more underground. Traffickers have changed their modi operandi, shifting increasingly to on-call services in private location, as one example. In addition, victims of trafficking find the assistance we currently offer of little use to them, since they are either returned to their countries of origin or caught up in the mechanisms of law and order in a foreign country. And in the discussion, I could also tell you more about this very problem. One of the main problems is the identification of victims of trafficking. There is reason to believe that authorities throughout the region and beyond, because also in other destination countries in Europe, show little interest in identifying victims of trafficking in order to avoid the necessity of providing appropriate protection and assistance to them. One of the first lessons we have to learn is that we have to know what we are looking for if we wish to identify trafficking situations, be it trafficking for sexual exploitation or for labor exploitation, be it trafficking in children and minors or internal trafficking. Let me tell you an example, which is a true story. It's not invented, and I came across during my country visits. It's an EU member state, by the way. And so I came there, and there was on this very day an article in the newspaper. And the situation was the following, and I had addressed the chief of police on this matter. The situation was that some 50, 60 Indians were invited to work on by a foreign contractor firm to work on a construction site for the state hospital of this country. These Indians In this country, there is they have a minimum wage. So the Indians were paid a very small percentage of this minimum wage. They were crammed together, 20, 30 in one room, and their passports had been confiscated or, you know, taken away or kept by this contractor firm. And I confronted the police with this. This is a typical trafficking case. And you know what he answered? And this might be, it's not an exception, I fear. He said, well, you know, what's the problem? I mean, the question of the wages, this has nothing to do with us. This is a question for the trade unions, you know. The fact that they are crumped together, you know, oh, well, this might be a cultural thing, you know, Indians in general are crumped together, so what, you know? And it's really the truth. And on the passports, he compared the fact that the passports were confiscated with the situation that we hand over in a hotel a passport, and in some countries you don't get it immediately back, you know, so they keep the passport, yeah? So this was his approach to it, and therefore, I mean, it is important to know what we are looking for if we wish to identify trafficking situations. A lesson that may be even more important for us to learn is that we must not deny the fact that there is a problem. Nobody has ever solved anything by denying it. Many future or potential victims typically leave their country willingly or voluntarily. This is still a discussion point and is not very much understood, that this is not the main point on human trafficking. So most of them leave their country willingly. This is what we know. Only about 10% are kidnapped. Traffickers exploit the fact that people do not have employment and or sustainable wages. These people are most often lured by misleading offers to work abroad. In this regard, standard awareness campaigns have not proved effective in the face of people's fundamental need for livelihood. So to raise awareness of the risks is certainly one thing, but living in a situation where you don't know how to live is another thing. And many people would nevertheless go abroad and try to find work abroad. Given the fact that many victims leave their countries willingly, there are those who are little familiar with trafficking cases who think that this is simply migration or people smuggling or illegal migration. This is wrong. At some point, usually only after a person crosses the border, the traffickers brutally reveal their criminal intentions to her or him. It is how they use the people, what they subject them to, that makes it a trafficking case. Whether she or he initially departed his or her home country voluntarily is irrelevant. I know those dealing with human trafficking, they know, but you wouldn't believe that so many others do not. So therefore, it seems important to me to emphasize this very point. Internal trafficking in the whole Southeastern European region and beyond is increasing, which means that people are trafficked within the borders of their own country. Because also on internal trafficking, this is sometimes not understood. What is it? Yeah? And I believe, I know that internal trafficking is also a huge problem in the United States. Yeah, in large countries anyway it is. Often victims are temporarily trafficked within a country prior to their transfer abroad. So far, identification efforts have been focused primarily on foreign victims, and there is little, if any, concerted effort to identify and assist national citizens. Yet, there is no meaningful or justifiable distinction between the need for assistance of a foreign or a national victim of trafficking. Research shows that almost no victims of trafficking are identified at border crossing points or by consular personnel. I would also like to emphasize that. This is important. On the other hand, this calls for better anti-trafficking training of border guards and consular staff on the one hand, and on the other hand, we must understand that when people cross the border, they may not yet be aware of the fate in store for them, namely becoming victims of trafficking. I mean, you are all familiar with this film, Lilia Forever. This clearly shows, you know, at the border there is nothing because she doesn't know, you know, the problem of being trafficked starts later. It was found that many people have not been identified as victims of trafficking when they are returned. Up to 40% of people expelled from countries of destination were found to be trafficking victims who had never been identified as such. This points to the limits of immigration-based approaches to the trafficking phenomenon. So very often, because we, many countries, let me say, maybe there's a strong word, but pretend to be willing to fight trafficking in human beings, but in reality, it's an immigration response. You know, they believe that the human trafficking is illegal immigration. Recruitment methods also have changed over time and vary from country to country. New recruitment strategies include the loverboy method. There are, you know what I mean. I mean, young boys and boys and young men try to approach young women, tell them that they fell in love, and later on, finally, they force them into prostitution. There are more female recruiters. Was found out by the regional clearing point, often former victims of trafficking, and there is more recruitment by male-female couples. The age trend shows that traffickers apparently target increasingly younger victims. The number of trafficking victims in Southeastern Europe who were still teenagers when they were first discovered has doubled in recent years. And in some countries in Southeastern Europe, children and minors account for the majority of assisted victims. Another fact is the emerging presence of internally trafficked people, and among them, a high number of minors. Also at the international level, trafficking in children and minors is rising at an alarming rate. To counteract this appalling development, many countries in Southeastern Europe have established subgroups on child trafficking within their existing national structures, and the task of these groups has been to draw up comprehensive action plans for preventing and combating child trafficking and to take concrete measures that are in the best interest of the trafficking of the trafficked children. And again, in the discussion, we could discuss a bit more how to do that and why children have to be treated in a different way than adults. By the way, national plans of action to combat trafficking, including child trafficking, must provide, I mean, many countries do have national plans of action, but as long as they remain paper, it's not very helpful. So very often, it's not understood. You know, some countries are very proud to finally have designed a national plan of action, you know, but this can be done nowadays. It really can be done within an hour, you know, because on paper, in theory, this is quite easy. But the main thing is that there are clear-cut divisions of responsibility. So who is responsible for what, which ministries are involved, who has to do what. They must have precise time frames also so that it's possible to monitor where we are and what works and what doesn't. And of course, there must also be budgeting. This is also important because to have action plans where you don't have the money to implement it is also not very helpful, lest they remain toothless recommendations. The moment of identification of potential victims of trafficking is the crucial, the critical moment in all of this. If an individual is not recognized as a trafficking victim, there is no chance of rescue and little or no chance of initiating a case against the traffickers. Victims of trafficking, not only in Southeastern Europe, are identified almost exclusively by law enforcement, by police officers. So it depends on their insight into the problem, whether people are recognized and classified as victims or not. It depends on their insight into the problem, whether victims of trafficking are correctly treated. And it depends on, and referred, correctly referred. And it depends on them whether a case will be followed up by the prosecutor or not, as it is for them to question the victims and to prepare the files. While we must encourage law enforcement to better identify and rescue trafficking victims, we must at the same time create a significant and significantly strengthen networks of points of contacts and support services so that victims can turn and access an immediately supportive environment that will permit the victim a needed initial period of recovery. By the way, you know, the new Council of Europe convention, in the conventions let down the reflection period. So they need an initial period of recovery prior to a decision to help the mechanisms of law and order. When mentioning that, this seems quite logical, and when doing so in front of human rights activists, then it's very clear. But in practice, believe me, it is not. You know, countries would pretend to have a reflection period, but this reflection period is very often misused again for the purposes of state interests and not for the purposes of the interests of the victims. Ultimately, this approach will better serve victims' needs and the requirements of law enforcement than the current one. Another problem arises from the continuing practice among many police to use an interrogation strategy which tries to take the person interrogated by surprise. Often at the crime scene itself or shortly after a raid, for instance. It is argued that a statement given immediately after taking an individual into custody or arrest is more likely to be true and unfalsified because the people concerned are not given the chance to think over their statement or to monitor their behavior. In contrast to this, NGOs who are service providers for victims of trafficking have found that victims need a period for recovery and recuperation from their traumatic experience and for developing trust in foreign authorities and institutions. Only on the basis of longer supportive contacts and regular talks are victims willing to tell their story and even to testify and finally to uphold their statements. The lesson we can learn from this is that identification of victims of trafficking should not be exclusively carried out by police because of this or by law enforcement. Because of this element of uncertainty. It should rather be jointly done by law enforcement and NGOs or by law enforcement and international organizations. During this above mentioned reflection period needed for recovery, demands should not be placed on the victims by authorities, nor should they be forced to decide on their future commitments. And this is new and this is not being done in practice. In many countries, there is a lack of structured and systematic cooperation between law enforcement officers and those who run the victim protection centers. Mutual distrust is rooted in the different objectives and often in the reluctance of both parties to communicate with each other. This is a great disservice to trafficked victims. Although cooperation between law enforcement and NGOs has improved, it is improved in many countries, it is still unsatisfactory. So I believe it's high time that we overcome the leftover of the outdated view that the rights and the needs of trafficking victims are inimical to effective law enforcement. This is short-sighted and will ultimately undermine law enforcement efforts. Since trafficking victims currently provide the primary source of witnesses for the prosecution, a victim-centered approach by law enforcement is not only consistent, but logical in order to achieve law enforcement objectives. Many officials are at best trained to identify victims of sex trafficking, but have no idea how to identify victims of trafficking for labor exploitation, for instance, or other forms of human trafficking. So what is called for is thorough training of law enforcement officers, both frontline and special investigators, of prosecutors and judges, and of course of other authorities dealing with trafficking issues. Training, not awareness raising, in terms of having a curriculum and teaching new skill sets over several days based on a victim-centered approach. Team teaching by law enforcement officers and NGO representatives has proved highly effective and adds a new quality to education and training. States, as I said at the beginning, must play a crucial role also in changing the perception of victims of this crime. This will have to start with governments themselves recognizing them as victims and with the way they treat them. This will happen when countries establish the status and protection of these victims as consistent with being victims of a crime and not with criminals. It is also important to understand, because frankly, let me just say a word. Still, you know, when speaking about human trafficking, what people have in mind are prostitutes, illegal workers, illegal aliens, to put it in a nutshell, suspects of all sorts. This is the reality, and it's so difficult to make them to understand that what we're actually concerned with are victims of a serious crime. It is also important to understand that there does not exist a prototypical victim, a trafficking victim. They have diverse profiles, and this diversity must be addressed appropriately by authorities, law enforcement, and service providers. And it's also important to understand that there is not a difference between a good victim and a bad victim, between an innocent victim and a guilty victim. A victim is a victim and needs our support. A particular and problematic issue arises from the interference between various laws, more specifically between the laws on trafficking and the legislation on immigration in many countries, also in Southeastern Europe, but in other Western European countries too. Since crossing borders illegally is a crime in most countries, victims of trafficking are often prosecuted for being illegal aliens. Some have false documents, for instance. This is a serious obstacle to a successful prosecution because it impedes and prevents the cooperation between the victim and the authorities. And this holds particularly true for children, frequently trafficked and forced to commit petty crimes, to steal, for instance, pickpockets, yeah? These children must under no circumstances be treated as criminals, and they must not be put into centers for juvenile delinquency. States must ensure that victims of trafficking will not be made liable for offenses arising from the trafficking situation. I'm of course aware that this is a very sensitive issue, but I believe this needs to be discussed. Another objective in the fight against human trafficking is, of course, to disable trafficking networks. And to do this, the traffickers must serve time in jail reflecting the severity of this crime. Therefore, we are pushing for harmonizing legislation, for having appropriate penalties, etc. Then it's necessary that the leaders or the kingpins or the bosses of the trafficking organizations, they must be tracked down and apprehended. Getting the leaders of the criminal enterprises will not be easy, but we cannot pretend that anything short of that will disable a trafficking network, because one would prosecute or sentence a trafficker in one country, but in general, this does not even inconvenience the whole trafficking network. You know, such a person would be replaced by two other ones doing an even better criminal job than the others. So therefore, it's important to get also the bosses, the kingpins. Law enforcement must go also after the network itself, from the beginning in the countries of origin to the end users in the countries of destination. They must seek to disrupt the chain of trafficking from the beginning to the end by targeting the perpetrators along the entire continuum, including those aiding and abetting human trafficking. This is not an easy undertaking, but less than that will not be successful. This includes also investigating and going after the financial assets of the network. The money, this is the lifeblood of organized crime. the financial records of the organized human trafficking enterprises and the locations where they are kept have to be targets of investigations. And let me say, this, of course, is not behind the bar. So what I mean is that we have to do more and to look into the complexity and not just focusing on bar raids. I would now like to say a few words on the NATO and UN troops in Southeastern Europe and on their as peacekeepers in Southeastern Europe and on NATO's and UN's role and responsibility in the fight against human trafficking. You're probably aware, and Sarah Mendes knows better because she has done research. She has helped develop NATO's anti-trafficking policy. But again, it's important to look into what effect, how do they implement such policies, and can this be done without connection to the whole environment. And I would like to focus on the fact that human trafficking being a very complex issue, institutions like NATO and UN have, of course, to join into this broader picture, and their policy have to link up with the general policy and picture. It is well understood that because the fundamental character of human trafficking is a chain of criminal behavior, no country, no organization, no institution or agency alone can fight human trafficking successfully. But it is also true that countries and NATO allies and partners, as well as others, battling human trafficking as countries of origin, transit, or destination cannot be effective in the absence of consistent and supporting policies of important organizations such as the UN and NATO. So, as part of their security and peacekeeping role, it is crucial for NATO's policies and practices to support other anti-trafficking efforts. This is one more important piece of the puzzle that makes up the comprehensive strategy which must be adopted in order to have any chance of success against the traffickers. No well-designed law, policy, or program can work effectively if it is surrounded by weak or ineffective laws, policies, or programs. Effective programs are conceived and implemented with an understanding of how they fit into a larger, comprehensive, integrated and sustained strategy. This is how pragmatic approaches and concrete results are achieved. This is why UN's and NATO's efforts must be seen in terms of how they can best fit into the larger comprehensive efforts already underway. So the question to ask must be, in what way can NATO and UN contribute to these efforts? One of the preconditions will certainly be to institute a policy that prohibits conduct on the part of peacekeeping forces which could contribute to human trafficking. This is clear. A zero tolerance policy will have to be implemented as an essential measure designed to eliminate any activities that promote, support, or sanction human trafficking. Such a policy would certainly include clear formulated rules of conduct, will include incorporating standard clauses and provisions in all work contracts. This will include the implementation of training programs. This is, by the way, underway and being developed already. Training programs designed to educate military personnel, but also contractors and law enforcement personnel regarding human trafficking. This will have to include imposing suitable sanctions and penalties on misconduct. It will also include increasing law enforcement efforts to place offending entertainment establishments off limits. It will include examining human trafficking matters as part of established inspection activities. And it will include the establishment of evaluation programs as well as regular inspection and assessment programs. But the effectiveness of all programs and measures will largely depend on making people understand the why. Unless they understand the why, they will not be convinced of the how or what, which approach to take to the victims of human trafficking, how to treat them correctly, how to use the available tools properly, and which measures to take in which situation. Any law, code of conduct, regulation, or guideline will be effective only if those concerned understand not just the letter of the regulations, but the spirit of it. Only then will they develop a sense of responsibility and accountability. We must find the means to make people, including the peacekeepers, internalize the reality of modern manifestations of slavery, to make them see the problem and really understand it. And the longer I work on this issue, the more I'm convinced that this is the main part. No PowerPoint presentation of estimates, facts and figures can convey the horror of the stark reality of the trapped individual. Another aspect worth considering is putting human trafficking into the right analytical framework. So addressing it primarily, which is being done, you know, at the NATO, addressing it primarily as a force protection issue without addressing the inhumanity and human rights violation misses the mark. The personnel will not understand why they should not engage in activities that bolster human trafficking. The anti-trafficking strategies resulting from the first rationale are not the same as the strategies that result from the other. In this connection, I would like to plead for broadening the, as it's called, the establishment-based strategies. Drawing up lists of off-limits establishments has inherent limitations, given the sophistication of traffickers. Experience tells that traffickers respond by moving women and girls into less obvious and outwardly innocuous locations, such as private apartments, massage clubs, restaurants, etc. The locations used by traffickers are becoming more and more diverse in response to the steps taken to thwart them. So targeting demand is important, but it is only one element of a comprehensive strategy. The true character of human trafficking, its complexity, precludes single focused responses, and it must not be equated with one of its component elements. There is a danger that human trafficking is seen solely as a problem of illegal migration, or solely as a labor market issue, or solely as a demand-driven problem, or solely as a problem of organized crime. This is a tunnel vision that completely misjudges the complexity of human trafficking and will not lead to a sustainable solution. Once people have grasped the why they are supposed to do or not to do certain things, they will no longer depend on exhaustive lists of off-limits locations, but deliberately avoid anything that may support human trafficking. I would suggest to encourage and support this type of broad perspective in the development of programs for peacekeepers and other international personnel. I also believe that the UN, the UN's and NATO's anti-trafficking strategies should travel with NATO personnel, and that no distinction should be made between places of work and places of recreation, because this is also in discussion. You know, well, we don't care what they do, you know, when they have free. So I believe this is not as easy as that, and that they must extend to all contractors and subcontractors. All sending countries should subscribe to a zero-tolerance policy which knows no exceptions in cases concerning the involvement of their nationals in human trafficking, and that sanctions and penalties will reflect the severity of the crime. Immunity must not be misused to screen those who commit a serious crime and human rights violation. The risk of prosecution would be certainly a helpful deterrent, because as long as they believe, well, anyway, it doesn't matter, you know, I go back home or I go somewhere else, this is certainly not helpful. So finally, human trafficking is not only a security or law enforcement issue. There are many committed non-governmental and international organizations that have much experience in this matter, and I would like to suggest that UN and NATO engage in partnership with them in order to see the broader picture. So I've certainly not been able to cover everything that I would have liked to on this important topic, but I hope that this gives additional things to think about and may encourage a lively discussion. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much. I think you have beautifully address the issue of what I call the paper paradox, where we have lots of paper. We have paper that says a lot of the right things, but we're at a stage in our efforts to combat human trafficking. And frankly, I think we're at a stage in larger human rights issues where we have lots of paper, we have laws, but we have a tremendous amount of difficulty implementing policies. There are many laws which countries, organizations ignore, and there's a kind of institutionalized impunity in a lot of the international human rights machinery. So it's, you see human trafficking embedded in a larger set of issues. But certainly the burden for us in talking about how to combat human trafficking, how to combat it in peacekeeping situations, is how to make these pieces of paper real. And the perceptions of law enforcement, the perceptions of those involved in peacekeeping have to be changed. And how do we do that? And what does it mean to get beyond awareness training? How do you do really meaningful training so that there's a kind of shift in culture, there's a shift in people's understanding? We're not going to solve all those issues today, but perhaps we'll get a little bit further. I want to open the floor for questions, and I ask that you please identify who you are and the organization that you're with. Thank you. I'm going to start a list, so we'll start over there. Martina?
My name is Martina Vandenberg. I'm with a private law firm here in Washington, D.C., but previously I researched trafficking in Bosnia. Thank you so much, Dr. Conrad, for those very interesting remarks that were very comprehensive and very thoughtful, that I think many of us here in the room agree with. My question, though, is twofold. One of the things that you didn't mention is corruption. And I wondered if you could comment on the role of corruption, particularly among local law enforcement, and strategies for combating corruption in the region. And then the second question involves the references that you made to international organization personnel and the demand side issue. I think one of the things that gets lost in the debate is the issue of international organization personnel, including U.S. military contractors, as perpetrators. And I'm wondering if you know of any cases of any personnel from any international organizations posted in Southeastern Europe who were found to have engaged in trafficking, who were then prosecuted either in the region or in their home country.
Yeah, go ahead.
Human trafficking couldn't exist and thrive to such an extent without corruption. In some countries, it's almost a sort of culture of corruption, no? And we lobby for a way of dealing with this that corrupt officials, for instance, should not be prosecuted simply for corruption, but really for being for aiding and abetting trafficking, for supporting human trafficking, and would have to be punished with severe penalties. But again, very often, and this is a fact, unfortunately, and we are not at the point that we can say we have solved the problem. Very often, corrupt officials are supported by corrupt politicians, and it is accepted. You know, it starts sometimes just maybe preparing a file which cannot be used, you know, or at the borders, you know, not to see the facts, not to see what is going on, and to allow for further proceeding with this criminal business. So from smaller corrupt activities to high corruption, where they are bribed, of course, and sometimes there is an excuse, or people say we would have to look into the fact that police officers are not very well paid. You know, in some countries they almost earn, I don't know, maybe €100 or $100 per month. And of course, being involved in a trafficking situation provides them with money for themselves and their families for a whole year. And the problem really is that they don't understand that also, you know, smaller things which contribute to human trafficking are that this is corruption, and we hopefully find ways of prosecuting that. But it is not easy, because in some countries there's real a culture of corruption. It's so usual to organize these things in some way. So one of our, we have, if I may say so, in the OSCE also, we have a body which we call the Strategic Police Matters Unit. So they also work on this issue, trying to teach how police should behave so that people can have trust in them, etc., etc. So anyway, what is important is to repeat that human trafficking is, of course, nothing separate from other things which are going on, you know, from further democratization process, from developing sustainable institutions, etc. But corruption is a huge problem. And you mentioned the second issue. Of course, in Southeastern Europe, there were cases where peacekeepers and UN police were involved in trafficking cases, and it was not easy to make the leaders to understand that there is a difference between being followed up or prosecuted because they had an accident, a car accident, for instance, or for being involved in human trafficking. So it took us quite a while. The situation, let's say, has changed slightly. I believe there is more also because of your study you did and others. There is now a bit more understanding that human trafficking is a serious crime, and that there is a responsibility for everybody, and not to shift it to others. Because on NATO and UN, very often the arguments were that, well, we cannot do anything. You know, it's the countries, they send us the people. You know, so what? You know. And then, you know, the responsibility was shifted from from one to the other, and in reality there were no sanctions, and they just could, the offenders could just proceed their criminal activities, and first you saw them in Kosovo and then in Bosnia and then somewhere else. This is not acceptable, but this is addressed at least. It's the those responsible are more aware of it. I wouldn't go so far to say the problem is solved, but the problem is on the table. And
so I take it that that was zero prosecutions in the region, right? You probably all know, but Martina is the author of Hopes Betrayed, which Human Rights Watch published in December 2002. Do you want to wait for the?
Thank you.
Gail Gottlieb with Vote People SOS. I had two unrelated questions. The first is, I was intrigued by your mention of the reflective period, period for reflection after a trafficking victim is first identified. But I'm just wondering if you could explain a little bit under what legal authority, perhaps, the victim could be held for this period. Is it a matter of the threat of charges being levied later, or is it some sort of adult protective custody sort of arrangement, that sort of thing? I'd just like to understand it a little better. And then my other unrelated question had to do with Dr. Conrad explaining that once the human rights dimension of trafficking is explained, it's hoped that potential customers would avoid patronizing establishments where trafficking takes place. I had heard a presentation by somebody involved in child sex tourism, and he indicated that they had tried repeatedly to explain or discourage customers from patronizing places where child sex trafficking takes place by explaining the incredible harm to the children, and that these approaches had fallen flat repeatedly, and that only the threat of prosecution seemed to have any sort of deterrent effect. I'm just wondering, maybe for your opinion on an approach that might penalize customers of trafficking establishments, maybe under two different paradigms, one where they know or have reason to know that trafficking is taking place in this particular brothel, or on the other hand, a sort of standard of strict liability, whereby if it is in fact determined later that the woman was trafficked, there would be a penalty, I mean that the John could be, is that the right term? Yes, the John, the customer, could be somehow prosecuted for involvement in trafficking.
Helga, before you respond, let me just say that in my own research, this idea that if you explain somehow that this is a human rights abuse, that that will change behavior, change perception, I think it's not clear, certainly in peacekeeping settings, that that is the case, and that it may work for a certain percentage of people, peacekeepers, but that there's a reason why I think those involved in peacekeeping have talked about force protection, because they want to make an argument about security, their security. But I think this other argument about prosecution is an extremely powerful one, and that ultimately it's by having prosecutions in the field that you're going to really see, then the message will be delivered home. But it's, again, this sort of multi-focal approach as opposed to only one, you know, it's everything. And by making a complex argument, you're going to reach more people.
No, I completely agree, you know, and on children it's anywhere clear, you know, no discussion on this, and also for the peacekeepers, you know, in to be sent in regions, you know, where we know that 90% or even more so, you know, are trafficking victims, so there is not we can't start a discussion, you know, whether they had known or not known, you know, so there is I really would go for a clear zero tolerance policy, and also for prosecution, as I said, you know, because if there are no sanctions, then so what? We all know how people are. This is one part, but the other part, which probably we are not very much, to explain somebody to explain something to somebody is of course not enough, you know, because to change the mind, to make them to understand what's going on is an intensive effort, if I may say so, and this is something we have not been focusing so much on it. So I deeply believe we could do much more in this regard. starting from schools, you know, from within the education system. So this is important, and we will have to focus at that, on this, because otherwise it's not really helpful. This is what we also see with governments, frankly speaking. You know, what many governments or most of the governments have learned is the wording now. You know, I mean, I can meet with them and I get the appropriate answers, you know, but then asking a bit, just a detail, you know, you quickly realize there is no understanding of what it is, but they simply have learned to be politically correct. They know what we wish to hear, and they would tell us that, you know. So I deeply believe in more addressing this issue and really training, really raising awareness and do something on the education side. I believe this is important, because otherwise we won't go nowhere, as long as we don't understand that this is a horrendous violation of human rights, that this is a really manifestations of modern day slavery, and that is unacceptable that we have this in the 21st century. As long as this is not the case, it's very difficult, you know. We will have some measures here, some measures there, but we are not able to curb this crime.
Did you want to comment on the reflection period? Keep your hand.
Oh, sorry, yeah, on the reflection period. Or should I say that? The reflection period, you know, this was a long discussion in the Council of Europe Convention, in the newly established Council of Europe Convention on Action Against Trafficking in Human Beings. It means that law and order or law enforcement of a country should not immediately interrogate the victims, should not immediately question them, and that the victim should not be forced to make immediately to decide immediately what to go on, whether they would testify, and because if they don't do, the reality in most of the countries is that victims of trafficking not being willing to cooperate with law enforcement or with authorities are immediately expelled or sent back to their home countries. So we believe that they should have a period of time anyway, reduced to, the discussion was on a longer period of reflection, but reduced to 30 days of reflection period. A police officer who finds a potential victim of trafficking should immediately transfer this victim of trafficking to a service provider, which in general would be NGOs, and where they could stay. And this is not a custody, so they should also be free to move. It's not closed whatever houses, because then it wouldn't make much difference to a jail or another, or a detention center or whatever.
One of us must have said something provocative, because all of a sudden we have many, many people who want to ask questions. So I think what we're going to do is take questions in clusters, and let's start with Carla.
My name is Carla Menares-Burry. I'm from the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking Persons at the State Department. We are tracking very closely what is happening in the UN with regard to reform on involving peacekeepers and sexual exploitation and abuse. And one of the things we are very concerned about is we have seen reports where, for example, in Africa, there are peacekeepers who are repatriated back to their country, but because their country regulates or tolerates prostitution, no further action is taken against those peacekeepers. So, as I know, in Europe, there are many countries that do tolerate and regulate prostitution. So how do we deal with that situation where we're trying to say, don't exploit victims, but it seems like, you know, if they go back to their country to be, because they've engaged in it, nothing seems to happen. So how do we deal with that disparity between regulating prostitution and not prosecuting those who engage in it in another country?
Before you answer the question, we're going to take one from behind.
Yes.
Okay, hi. Michael Smith from the Salvation Army. And Salvation Army has, you know, facilities in every zip code in the United States. So we're trying to educate our staff how to recognize human trafficking that may be in our domestic violence shelters and our homeless shelters. They're coming in for, you know, emergency assistance. So my question is, One of the concerns that staff have is how involved organized crime is involved in trafficking in the United States. So if they try to help somebody escape their trafficking, what risk does that put our staff at? So if you could comment just on how involved organized crime is in trafficking in the United States, that would be helpful. And then my follow-up question. Can I have a follow-up question? Okay. Just a little bit more about just what services victims receive in Europe and other places around trauma. And so I like this notion of a kind of a reflection period and how long that is. And then what services do they receive in terms of restoration from the trauma? Thanks. Who's next?
Take those two and briefly, and then we'll move on.
So it is unacceptable, you know, that those involved in human trafficking in whatever way going back home and they are not prosecuted, you know. And of course, this is a fact, and not only a fact in Africa, unfortunately, it's also a fact in Europe. Yeah, and I know several countries, you know. So, but we try to change that, you know. So this would be part also of NATO policy, I understood, you know, to involve also the sending countries, you know, and to see that they take the responsibility. But what I don't understand, really, what I haven't understood is what this should have to do with regulating prostitution, legalizing it or not, you know, because, may I just say what I, because, you know, I have in the OEC we have countries, they have different approaches. So you know, we have the Swedish model criminalizing the clients. We have prosecution illegal, like in the US. You have it decriminalized, as we say. Nobody clearly knows what it is, but you know, sort of decriminalized in most of the other countries. Et cetera, et cetera. But all these ways, you know, to we have not seen by focusing mainly or exclusively on prostitution, we have not seen a change or a decrease or an increase in human trafficking. Because in the Netherlands, for instance, prostitution is considered as legal work, you know, but this doesn't say very much about the illegal market of human trafficking. Or in Sweden, I mean, sorry, to lean back and to say, well, we have a law, therefore we have no trafficking anymore, is simply not true. You know, I could tell you what happens in Sweden. You know, the new forms of the traffickers find, this is there. Or in the United States, I mean, sorry, you have all over the country, prostitution is illegal. You have a huge problem of human trafficking, you know? And so how should I say, addressing human trafficking means that we have to see and to understand what it is, and we have to address human trafficking. And a measure to prostitution is not a measure against or in favor of human trafficking. But again, if somebody, and we spoke about the peacekeepers, is involved in a human trafficking case, it's clear that the country, the sending country, has a responsibility, and they must prosecute such a person and should not, you know, just cover it up, and we all know what it is. So this is at least from the experience I have, and I have seen quite a lot of different ways to deal with that. So we would finally we would have to address human trafficking, you know, to find out what it is and to be willing to acknowledge what it is. Then we could also find maybe appropriate responses to it. The other thing was organized crime. Yes, of course, human trafficking or organized crime is part of human trafficking, or human trafficking part of organized crime, although there are also other forms of it. And I don't know if I got the question right. Of course there is a danger, you know, in protecting and assisting victims in dismantling networks. There is the danger, you know, that organized criminals would address those who support or who assist and help the victims. But on the other hand, I don't have any solution. I don't know if you have. But of course, one would have to be careful. But you cannot guarantee, you know, that this is not a difficult situation. And I have been in difficult situations myself, you know, because of course it's criminals, and you know, pointing to them. and trying to dismantle that and to prosecute them, they don't like it. So you could come in a situation which is dangerous. But I don't know whether you
I'm sure there are organizations, representatives in the room who work with victims' assistance who might contact the colleague from Salvation Army and share how they handle this. We had a man actually, or a man in the back, and then the woman directly in front of him, and then we're going to move to this side of the room.
Hi, I'm Jeremiah Barenberg from the U.S. Helsinki Commission. Mm-hmm. I have two questions, and I hope you'll forgive me if I reveal my ignorance. But in listening to your talk, I couldn't help but think, and I'm not sure if this is an appropriate corollary, but critics of, let's say, this country's approach to the drug problem would suggest that there's been all too much focus on interdiction and the lack of measures that deal with the root causes or something like that. Could you address that and see if that relates mm-hmm. here? And also, have you heard, like I heard, that in Germany in the lead up to the World Cup, that they were looking into creating a zone where they would sort of anticipate the likelihood of all the fans coming in and having a demand for a prostitution or something like that, if that's something you've heard of. Thank you.
Catherine Chen from Save the Children. Save the Children works in both conflict and post-conflict areas, mm-hmm. working to protect the well-being and livelihood of children and their families. And in the situation of conflict, we've often seen, obvious, as you've mentioned, Dr. Conrad, that the presence of peacekeepers as well as other international personnel increases the demand for prostitution. But and the related, you know, all this discussion that we've been having about peacekeepers and prostitution. However, have you seen an increase in demand for other forms of exploitative labor, for example, for men, for other children, for domestic service, or for other types of demand? Because certainly in a lot of the conflict areas where I work in Africa, that it's not exclusively for prostitution. That's obviously the most obvious issue. And then also just one very quick comment related to her comment,
Carla's comment.
I know for the case in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the issues from MONUC, mm-hmm. the peacekeeping operations, as I'm sure you know as well, that Nepal prosecuted 7 of its peacekeepers in that situation, and they used it as an opportunity to display a little bit of force, that they were in fact taking trafficking a little bit more seriously. And so just wanted to support your comment that the more we understand about what the root causes are, the more we understand about why people are being trafficked and for what purposes, then countries are going to be much more able to actually ground their prosecutions in something. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Let's take one over here and then we'll respond. Can you move the mic over here? Oh, okay, great. There was
House Armed Services Committee. Mm-hmm. I had a question. You mentioned something before about the conflict between immigration laws and trafficking laws, and I had questions on how you would maybe an example of where they conflict specifically and how that could be combated, if there's an example of a place where it maybe is working better together. And also if immigration laws, that if there were a specific clause in certain laws that would help these victims, if that effort might not succumb to laws that if that would not be exploited perhaps by people that truly were illegal immigrants or terrorists, how this fits into combating terrorism and illegal immigrants coming in for those purposes.
Yeah, first of all, the root cause is a very important issue, you know, and one of the weakest at the same time, and one of the weakest because preventive measures, you know, are long-term measures, and very often also donor countries and countries who wish to support, you know, projects, they would like to see a quick a quick success, so to say. And preventive measures are really long-term measures. One of the reasons of my visit here is to meet with the World Bank, because I tried to find out whether they couldn't, you know, because what is important, you know, they are obviously their main goal is poverty reduction, but nobody looks into these programs really, whether they are directly or indirectly, what effect they have on human trafficking, you know, whether directly or indirectly some measures support human trafficking. I mean, still this old example, but maybe I can quickly repeat it. You know, in Moldova, you know, the very often the conditions for the the conditions for these loans, this structural adjustment loans, you know, are such that you have to cut social services, for instance. And in Moldova, they had a lot of village hospitals, you know, so they closed them down. The women had their jobs there, and it was also important for the health care of their families, you know. So this could be a measure, you know, I don't know, but one would have to look into that. But this could be a measure which indirectly supports human trafficking, because the people have to go abroad. So it is important to get also the international financiers to look into this issue, and hopefully the World Bank will do so. I mean, they didn't say, well, yeah, we just waited for you, and of course we will, but nevertheless.
Do we have any representatives from the World Bank here today? We can talk about this a little bit more. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And so, but this is just as an example. This is important, you know, because just to say, well, like in Southeastern Europe, what happened was to say, well, economic development, and that's it, and then the problem is solved, and there will be no trafficking. I believe it's not, first of all, it's not as easy as that, and then economic development programs very often go much more for social exclusion than for social inclusion, you know, and to look into that, and to get them on board, and to, again, this complexity is so important, you know, and to address it in its complexity and seriously, then probably we could be much more successful than we are. But again, prevention, root causes, this is most important, but long-term is a long-term issue, and very often reluctance here to
spend the money.
Just to spend the money, yeah, thank you, that's it, yeah. Then, of course, what you said, the trafficking for sexual exploitation, we have been dealing with this in Europe and in other parts, especially also in the United States, extensively. But there is another problem. This is huge, if not bigger than trafficking for sexual exploitation. This is trafficking for labor exploitation. Yeah, and we try to look into that. This is a huge problem in the United States. This is a huge problem in other countries. It's also in Russia, for instance. I mean, the neighboring countries, for instance.
Moscow.
Yeah, the neighboring countries, for instance, you know, they know that, you know, almost everybody finds migrates to for work to Russia, for instance, and of course this is will be similar difficult to make the difference and to draw the line between between a trafficked a victim of trafficking for labor exploitation and just a migrant. You know, so these are two things, and this will be similar difficult to find out what makes it a trafficking victim and what does it mean, how can we avoid that somebody becomes a victim of labor exploitation, for instance. And we just to announce that on the 7th, but we will put it on our website. On the 7th and 8th of November, 7th and 8th of November, we will have in Vienna at the OSCE an international conference on the issue of trafficking for labor exploitation. We will focus a bit on how to identify these cases, how to prosecute it, and also provide more information on what is it. And because very often legal ways, you know, it's not always illegal, you know, legal ways also lead to trafficking. And this is important to understand and to find out. Immigration, what I mean is that most of the victims of trafficking, frankly speaking, are not identified. They are anyway unaccounted for in the U.S. and everywhere. Yeah. So the problem really is that most of them, and we did some, you know, there is some in Southeastern Europe, we did some research. We found out that up to 40, sometimes up to 60% of victims of trafficking had not been identified. They were deported as illegal immigrants because they were meant to be illegal immigrants, and nobody looked into that. You know, they were sent to detention centers and then deported. And this is this doesn't make sense, especially with human trafficking, because we know that up to 50% are reintroduced, or we call it recycled, into the criminal cycle of trafficking. So this is not helpful. You know, but the tendency, the attitude in Europe, maybe even more so than here, but also here is a discrepancy between this T visa, who gets a T visa, because I believe the T visa is quite a good instrument, you know, to do that, but only very few people get a T visa, you know, so there is a discrepancy, and in Europe even more so, you know, the attitude is to get rid of these people, and we believe then the problem is solved. No, the problem is not solved with it, because it's just, it moves around more and more often. So this is what I meant with illegal immigration. Yeah, this one.
Okay. Well, you can combine your questions.
Thank you. My name is Laura Landberg. I work at the Organization of American States, Inter-American Commission of Women. Dr. Conrad, you started your presentation talking about the government's responsibility, accountability to combat trafficking. I have first questions related to what kind of monitoring system you foresee at the UN, at the OSCE, to receive complaints from victims, from relatives, to who could make complaints, what way, if there is any monitoring system at all planned in the future. My second question, a few days ago we saw in BBC World News a rescue of a group of very young Eastern women trafficked to London. They were in a massage parlor. And interesting that the unit, the police unit, in charge of rescuing them were all women, young women. I would like to know, if possible, if there is any specific training in the UK or any other countries to train women in charge of rescuing, because you mentioned very well that it would be better to have rescue carried out by police and by NGOs, if possible. In the case of a UK training women, young women, does it make a change in the rescue, or any other countries have experience? The third question, if I may, very short. Labor. There is corruption, as Martina Vandenberg mentioned at the beginning. Also, in other areas, consulates, we found in Latin America many cases of consulates with corruption doing business, and labor inspectors. The only example I can think of labor inspectors doing something good is in Brazil, rescuing victims, exploited victims that are internally trafficked, or from other countries with very few resources and with a lot of danger. Any plan to involve the labor, ministers of labor, inspectors in to combat trafficking? Thank you.
We're going to take one more over here. Yeah.
Hi, Jennifer Watley with World Learning. My question relates actually to, I think, what you're talking about a bit with the international institutions. Oftentimes countries, and particularly countries such as Bosnia and Kosovo, that have a large peacekeeping community, are also countries where the government is really not the ultimate authority. It's the international community. And that makes the government even more susceptible to the messages that it's receiving from the international community. When we're fighting trafficking, even if governments see the need, identify the problem, they have a number of priorities that they have to balance trafficking against. And I'm wondering, what type of messages is the OSCE sending? Is the international community sending? Is trafficking just one of many priorities, or is this something that governments are really being pushed to focus on?
Go ahead.
on the monitoring, the new convention, the Council of Europe Convention, foresees a monitoring, an official monitoring of the situation. So the countries the countries signing this convention must commit themselves to accept this monitoring process. So this is one official way. But of course, monitoring can also take place within a country. You know, one can also establish a system within a country and to look into that. So we promote, in Europe at least, but this can also extend to other countries, we promote the idea of having a national rapporteur, which is not exclusively a monitoring mechanism, but a national rapporteur, an independent position, not from one ministry, you know, and always being forced to describe, you know, what you do in order to counteract these criminal activities, but an independent position where these people would try to find to collect a quantitative and qualitative data and information on human trafficking, maybe on the trends, on the tendencies, yeah, and then with a report given to the parliament, discussed in the given to the government, discussed in the parliament. This could be a sort of monitoring, because then the issue will be made public, and there would also be public discussion. So on the one hand, this official mechanism, at least for those being part of the Council of Europe Convention, and on the other hand, one can also establish an own monitoring system. The OSCE has not an official monitoring system. You know, we do every now and then we do an assessment here or there. So this is being done, but there is no official mechanism in order to systematically do that. Then on the UK, let me say this is a typical example. You know how, I mean, we discussed for years. You know, it's 5 years. It's more than 5 years. You know, since the unveiling of the UN protocol. We discuss what to do. I mean, you can see what happened, you know? I mean, they haven't understood anything, you know? So they deported the victims, you know? They ill-treated them. We quickly tried to also to intervene, of course, you know, and to draw the attention to the fact that they should be treated as victims and properly referred to assistance and support and protection. But this is the real typical situation. Women and police, of course, it would be important to have more women in police. This is certainly in law enforcement. This is important, or simply for a victim also to be able to choose. You know, sometimes they don't want to speak with a man. You know, because having these traumatic experiences. You know, so this is for sure important. Labor again. You know, we all completely with you. This is necessary and important. We don't know enough about it. We start doing that. We would like to focus more on this labor exploitation, trafficking for labor exploitation, and forced and bonded labor, and to involve labor inspectorates, of course, because it is, you know, trafficking has links to prostitution, to migration, to other things, and how to treat people. This is a central point, you know, also on migration. If you ill-treat migrants, well, then they are fall easier prey to traffickers. So, and the same is with the labor situation, etc. So this is where we try to further develop. And on the what can be done in countries? What was the
priority of messages and whether or not?
Yeah. Well, we try to push. To push in a way that we tell them, look, this is a most important issue, but there are, it's like waves, you know, sometimes it's a bit higher at the agenda, sometimes not that much. At the moment, we will see, you know, I mean, it could be a good sign that the EU wishes to develop an action plan on this issue. But in general, it's true that human trafficking is, from governmental side, is seen as less important than other crimes. Yeah, this is a fact, although very often governments are not more successful in fighting other crimes, you know. But, if, you know, mentioning terrorism and organized crime, this is... very
robust.
robust, this is true. But we try, of course, to make them to understand that many things are also linked, you know, and that human trafficking needs to be addressed properly. What we promote is our coordination mechanisms within the country. Yeah? So that they have institutionalized coordination mechanisms, not just coming together every now and then, you know, when it fits into the plans. No, but a coordination mechanism with a national coordinator, with all the ministries involved, with the main relevant international organizations in countries like Bosnia and Kosovo, etc. You mentioned. You know, of course, there is the involvement of the international organizations is important because they can provide support, decision making aids, giving a hand on this. So we ask them to identify a multidisciplinary group. We call it working group, and they should on a regular basis deal with the issue and then also prepare for decision-making aids. This has proven quite effective, especially also in Southeastern Europe, but also beyond.
We're going to take a few more questions before we end. Granted that Dr. Conrad has the time, you've been waiting, and then Ruth, and then we'll call it a day.
My name is Phil Linderman with the OAS Anti-Trafficking Unit. Dr. Conrad, thank you for your remarks. Very specific question about Spain. One of the major trafficking routes across the Atlantic is from Latin America to Spain, as you know. We in the OAS have been engaged a long time trying to get a proper response from the government of Spain. We've had some difficulty. From your experience, Spain is an OSCE country. What advice would you give us to get a better political response and a technical support response from Spain?
Working with Refugees International. I'm originally from Bosnia, because today we're talking so much about Bosnia and Kosovo. Mm-hmm. So I have two kind of questions. First question is, I read Dr. Sarah Mendelson's report about the human trafficking, and I was very surprised, and I'm now very aware how serious the situation of human trafficking is. So my question is, the women from Moldova, Ukraine, Bulgaria, etc., what appeared to them to come to the unstable, in that time, Balkans, because of war from 92-95? Why I'm asking this? Because we have a lot of Southeast illegal labor force in Saudi Arabia, in Arab Emirates, in Yemen, and those are kind of stable countries. I mean, they're countries at peace, in a way. We know they have a lot of human violation rights. So what appeared to those women to come to the Balkans during the Bosnia War, 92-95, and the Kosovo from 99 till present? And the second question is, can you comment, were any Bosnian women involved in this human trafficking? I mean, were they trafficked because we know that their rights were violated during the war, in many camps, being raped and things like that? So thank you.
I wanted to actually, I guess Jeremiah just left. I was more something addressed to him too, but USCAD.
This is Ruth.
Ruth Poyman, sorry, USCAD. And I was going to say to Jeremiah, but he's left, that the, I know Helga Conrad wrote the introduction to a report that focused on prevention efforts this year, addressing root causes. The OSCE, ODIHR, UNICEF, and UNHCR report is available, I believe, on the OSCE website. And then USAID also did some research last year on root causes, sort of prevention efforts. And if you can't find that on a USAID website, I can send it to you, and you're welcome to come up to me afterwards. But however, we only work in developing and transition countries, and of course our resources are limited. What's good about USAID is we can support our direct anti-trafficking efforts with different indirect sort of development efforts, and that's one of the things we're trying to work on, is how to integrate what we're doing into other programs, whether it's microcredit, whether it's women's empowerment, whether it's money laundering and banking. I'm meeting someone in our office next week about that, and you know, a myriad of different efforts, whether it's rule of law, media, and so forth. And so, Dr. Conrad, I wanted to ask you about your new efforts, because you've done great work in Southeast Europe. What are the challenges of your new efforts in working with the Western governments, the members of the OSCE on this? And also, just yesterday, someone asked me a question, is anyone working with the European media, the sort of Western media, on how they cover this? Because I know USAID is trying to work with and training journalists and media. Thanks.
Let me just respond really quickly on trafficking into Bosnia. People who ended up in brothels held in Bosnia weren't volunteering to go to Bosnia. They may have been, thought they were going to work in Italy or Hungary or somewhere else, and then they ended up there. I mean, as in many cases in trafficking, people are, it's through force, fraud, coercion. So it wasn't, you know, I'm going to have a job in a post-conflict location. It's I've ended up in a post-conflict location where I've been trafficked to. Helga, do you want to?
No, I just like to underline. The Balkans, for years, the Balkan area really was a transit area, you know, so nobody wanted to go to the Balkans, you know, but they were stopped there, you know, and exploited there. And sometimes we had victims, you might also know, they had no clue where they were, you know, they thought they were in the United States, really, you know, some of them even, you know, they had really no idea what happened, yeah, so this was slightly different, and Bosnian women, of course, they are also found and exploited somewhere, and this is anyway a new trend. You know, you find also European citizens being exploited, so it's not just from the poorer countries to somewhere. So it's European citizens to be exploited somewhere. Yeah, and anyway, this is a trend we would have to look into and to find answers to that. Yeah, thank you for mentioning these reports, because they are important. They can really give at least, you know, a first insight into the problematic. What is necessary, and we see this also from your interventions, you know, that a challenge is really to fit the pieces of the puzzle together. You know, there are so many things being done, but the problem really is how do they fit to one piece that we are really able to curb this crime. This is not easy. Yeah? We try, but it's really not easy. And on the media, the OEC, as we said, you know, there was a strong wish by the participating states, because the Southeastern Europe, they thought they had done a lot, you know, so they felt really we should focus on the destination countries, which are the European countries, you know, mainly. And this was a big surprise, you know, because they had many of the European countries had funded projects in Southeastern Europe, but looking at their own country, they had no appropriate legislation, they had no action plan, they had no, you know, no understanding what human trafficking is, and this is still going on, you know, and UK was already mentioned, you know, many countries really have, you know, focus on something else, and it takes a while until they understand the whole situation. But I'm not aware that we have done training with media in European or in destination countries, but this is a good thing to reflect on.
We do it on a one-on-one basis here at CSIS. When media call, we walk through what the issue is. We're going to close now. I just want to say that on these issues of prevention.
Can I just say a word on Spain?
So yes. Very specific.
I don't have the answer, but I have scheduled a visit to Spain and the government, and I'll keep you updated on that.
In trying to shift perceptions and behaviors and trying to reach potentially vulnerable audiences, we need to have much more data and research on what people know about this issue. And unfortunately, there is no cheap way to do this. This is about opinion surveys. And those of you who know my work on Russia, this is no surprise. But we have not invested in doing scientific sampling of the populations that are vulnerable to trafficking, both females and males, how they understand migration, what they understand about opportunities for work abroad, what they know about trafficking. I think a lot of people think that everybody knows about this issue. And I work a lot in Russia. The major human rights organizations don't know about human trafficking, so there's no reason to think that young females or males know about it. So just a word to all of those as we're thinking about how to do better work on prevention. Thank you so much for being with us today, and we hope to see you soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.